interesting thing about this topic to me was that I didn't actually know that much about it. So the other episodes that I have done have all been in areas that I've been doing research in and I'm fairly well grounded. And as we were talking through ideas, I thought, you know what, there was something that had triggered this about a conference or some awards for folks that were doing education in these less developed areas. And I thought, you know, I work for this global company, and I've, on the other hand, grown up and I'm based in the U.S., and so I know I have these blind spots about what educational technology really looks like in less developed countries. And so I thought it would be really interesting to just hear from folks that were more deeply involved in that side of the education technology world about what their challenges were and what they thought the opportunities are.
And what was quite interesting was, you know, so the title was looking at less connected areas, but actually, you know, some of the experiences weren't about, you know, having less connectivity, but perhaps having a greater challenge on your time, and whether that's to do with your family or to do with learning. And so there's different pressures that perhaps neither of us had sort of perceived were that high priority as well.
Yeah, I definitely found some of my own misconceptions being challenged as I was listening to what the guests were saying. And on one hand, you know, I hear that educational technology can open up access and information to experts. And then there's this other idea, are we just, you know, reinforcing our current structures and the digital divide is widening? But the other questions that seem to come up were, of course, things like, if we're trying to learn in situations where someone's basic needs for safety and food and shelter aren't consistently met, then we are certainly not going to be the priority, is not always going to be long-term learning when there are short-term needs to bring in income and to be able to think about those other more pressing concerns for people than they currently have, which makes sense in what we're thinking about. But it's a good reminder that education doesn't happen in a vacuum socially. And we hear, I know even in the U.S. teachers talk about this, that we're not going to be able to, you know, fix everything just by fixing education, but that we need to think about what is the overall social structure look like and how are we supporting students in a variety of areas in their lives, and not just thinking about the learning environment, or even more specifically, what the learning technology looks like.
I suppose the huge disclaimer as well on this episode, so we've got guests from across Africa, Bangladesh, Jordan. So obviously, there's, you know, quite a distinct differences in those locations and situations. But I think what it did show is, yeah, some of the projects that are taking place. And as I mentioned in this episode, it's really scratching the surface. Hello everyone, and welcome to the Future Tech for Education series on the EdTech podcast, supported by Pearson. My name is Sophie Bailey, and over the past 9 episodes in this series, I've been exploring the challenges and opportunities of Future Tech for Education with contributors from across industry, research and academia. At the top of this week's episode, you heard from podcast series co-host Dr. Christine DiCerbo, Vice President of Education Research at Pearson. And in this final episode of the series, I look at EdTech internationally with a number of guests. We talk about a review of 130 reports on EdTech and what it tells us about best practice and evidence-based learning in emergencies and displaced settings. What are the common misconceptions about connectivity as a barrier to EdTech, and when are these well-founded? How can technology help scale access to teaching and learning? And how do we ensure learners still benefit from mentors and face-to-face teaching? And when it comes down to it, what comes first on a phone, a learning game, or a photo of your loved ones? All this and more in today's episode. To To kick off this episode, I spoke to Luke Stannard, a research consultant from Save the Children, about a new report 8 months in the making on EdTech in emergency settings. Here is what he said.
Yeah, well, we spent about a year on the study. We looked at over 130 academic studies that looked at EdTech use. We were specifically focusing on child-facing educational technology, so not necessarily looking at anything to do with teacher training or anything to do with, say, the payment of teachers through conditional cash transfers and so forth, which is quite a big area. However, we were looking at when a child has a piece of EdTech in their hands, what key areas can help to improve their engagement with that. So what do we find? That the provision of hardware alone isn't enough to improve learning outcomes. There's been quite a lot done on that, and that's, I think that's, we're starting to move beyond the idea that educational technology in its own right is going to improve learning outcomes, and we've had really positive receptions with that. We found out that, and in trying to encourage dialogue around what form of pedagogy or praxis is fundamental to improving learning outcomes. What else? Teachers are fundamental to the effective use of good EdTech, especially trained teachers. So educational technology that attempts to replace the teacher, if you're looking for long-term improvements in learning outcomes, we found that there was, you know, enough statistical evidence that proves that having the teacher next to the child and working with the group is of real benefit. And I think that's one of the areas that we really stressed, like, consider how their practice has changed as much. I guess there's two scenarios there. There's one where we haven't got enough teachers, and that's where EdTech can really provide a sort of supplementary role. So, for example, there's some fantastic research that shows some of the writing tasks children can be provided with immediate feedback. So, say they're working on, say, one tablet between four of them, and they're writing a small piece on a particular, it could be a poem or a story or whatever. They're having the EdTech software that gives them feedback on, say, words they've spelt wrong or suggestions on different language structures that they could use, allows the teacher, who perhaps has a classroom of 50 to 80 people, to be a more effective teacher. It doesn't replace them, but it allows them to help with people who are stuck or help with behaviour management issues. And so there is a real complementary role that the correct choice of EdTech software can definitely help with. I guess on the other side of things, and especially, for example, with regards to the Syrian refugee crisis, we have a large population, about 130 million, no, that's in the wider world, of children who do not have access to schools. And there's lots of socio-economic reasons behind that and so forth. So there is evidence that if they don't have access to school, that some form of EdTech is absolutely going to provide them with education and educational engagement that they wouldn't have previously. What we found is that if that EdTech for that potentially isolated family or child could encourage dialogue between, say, parents and their children about a particular topic, or between children, for example, brothers and sisters and so forth, maybe within the same environment, are more likely to improve learning. And so what we're really concentrating on is not having EdTech that just isolates the student, but encourages us to talk. And there's some fantastic work going on out there in that.
Unsurprisingly, the need to contextualise and fully understand a local situation is paramount. The idea of dialogue and co-creation won't be new to anyone who has read Paulo Freire's The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, but how is it being used in examples today? Here is Teodora Berkova, Director of Social Innovation at Pearson, talking about the need for extensive research and development and collaborative design in a project in Jordan.
These things do take a while to kind of set up and get off the ground. And really at the basis of everything that we do, there's always, regardless of the kind of educational challenge that we're trying to tackle, there's usually quite a bit of an upfront R&D process because we're essentially stepping into unknown territory. So we actually recruited a team of anthropologists to help us both with the design of the research and as well as the facilitation and engagement and coordination on the ground. And the way basically that it works is we have been working with many different families who are based in Jordan. Some of them are Jordanian, some of them are Syrian, who have kids. And we essentially set up workshop, co-design workshops and focus groups with kids from our target age group. Anytime, as I was mentioning from the beginning of the, even the concept. So a lot of the characters, really the kids came up with, the dynamic of the game, the themes, and then everything that's built essentially is tested. There's nothing like getting an 11-year-old to tell you their true opinion of your game. And it's really kind of phenomenal because we'll bring also the engineers and the developers with us, you know, who will say sometimes, well, this, you know, we had to build it like this because of this. And then when a kid is looking at you and saying, but that just sucks, like, that's it. We need to fix it. So, some of the kids we've been working with for over a year now, and they, you know, they actually see themselves as development partners in this application. And when they talk to friends, they'll say, I helped make this game. And they really have. And I think that that comes partly from, we know that we have so many different assumptions, and you have to really work with your target learner and truly put them at the center, and you realize all those, many of those assumptions actually fly out the window very quickly. So it really helps keep us, keeps us honest, you know, in what we're building and knowing who we're designing this for ultimately.
Whether you're in Afghanistan, Scotland, or Canada, it pays to go back to basics and ask what you want from any tool you are deploying.
And what we're referring to is kind of the EdTech Adoption Process Lite, which is, it's just a series of questions to ask yourself if you're an EdTech implementer at the start of the process. So there's kind of four categories for that. So the first is, you know, do you really understand the problem that you're trying to solve? If you're trying to implement EdTech because you like whiteboards because they're shiny, that's not a good reason to do it. You know, a better reason is, you know, you've got some very specific metrics, like, you know, 25% of my year 8 maths students are 6 months behind where they should be. I need to use some EdTech to be able to get these guys up to scratch. That's a much better, clearly defined problem. And you really need to have set metrics. So, you know, it's not good enough to say, oh, no impact when I see it. What you need to be saying is, you know, I want all of my students to be achieving a, you know, a C grade or above in their mock papers in 3 months' time. So really clear focus on metrics. Second bit is around preparedness. Are you really ready to do this? You know, have you thought through things like teacher and student capability? So this is something that we see a lot of, not really in our schools as well. This is our, with my Aga Khan hat on. I'm talking more schools in this market, that the level of language for teachers is perhaps not as high as it might be. So are your teachers literate enough to be able to utilize this stuff? Are your kids literate enough to be able to use it? Do they understand, you know, how to use a computer to be able to deliver this, or how to use a tablet, or how to use a phone? Because often we bake in these assumptions and they just don't work.
You just heard from Henry Warren, EdTech Lead for the Aga Khan Education Service, which operates over 200 schools and educational programs internationally. Once the research phase is complete and the brief of local teaching and learning needs surmised, what are some of the challenges which are being identified, and what is the role of technology in helping to solve them? One thing all the guests were clear on is that hardware on its own is not the solution.
How do you get schools to procure and then implement properly? Because we found this right the way across the world, Sophie. So much ed tech is procured just really badly and just sits on shelves and it's just not used at all. I mean, you just have to look at, you know, whiteboards being rolled out in the UK. I mean, how many of them are used just like blackboards or not at all? I found a digital whiteboard in, where was it, Mombasa, being used as a dartboard. So, you know, what we see a lot of, and I think this is true across the world, Sophie, is people will run a 20-minute training workshop and then assume that something has been implemented And that's just never the case. Having a proper implementation program where you're checking back with teachers and supporting them, because it's really hard to do a lot of this stuff, is absolutely crucial. If I could give one piece of advice to all the schools, is spend as much time and as much effort thinking through the implementation process as you do on which particular widget or piece of software that you're trying to buy. And then the final bit is around stakeholders, which a lot of these guys are often not considered. So, you know, who's going to be providing the support for this when it goes wrong? And it always does go wrong, by the way. There was always something that goes wrong. Are you talking to the different departments that might be utilizing this? Are you talking to parents as well? These guys are really key stakeholders.
Following up from Henry Warren, we spoke to Luke Stannard and Kobir Udin from Computers Are Free for Everyone, a UK charity providing free training in coding, design and electronics to underprivileged young people in Dhaka in Bangladesh. Kobir is a past student on the programme who now runs it in country.
And it was in 2010 that I wanted to go back, and Kobir had grown up a bit by then, and when I returned, we decided to try and recreate what he'd had, but on a larger scale for more people. So we set up with just one computer, and you might be probably familiar with Sugata Mitra, and kind of following that idea of putting it out there for anyone to use. But for us, it didn't work. The hardware was very cheap, not reliable, no one could fix it. They were always asking us to come and... We thought we need to be a bit more traditional, so we did set up just in a room in someone's house, starting lessons just at the weekend with four desktops, I think. And it kind of grew from there. In the beginning, we just taught Paint and Word and PowerPoint because no one had used a computer before. And as the years went on, we kind of became established as a registered charity, raised more money and moved to a bigger place and got more computers, started employing the students we trained as teachers, and it kind of expanded from there, and then built out the curriculum to include coding, you know, things like Scratch for children, and then App Inventor, and moving on to sort of more professional coding things and web development, graphic design. So yeah, that's a brief overview of how we've got to where we are. And the next problem, Kobir discovered, actually it's really hard to buy tablets in Bangladesh.
The cheap one,
yeah.
Because we can't really afford to give them really a high-end one, because we want to give it to as many people as possible. It would be like £200 in a high-end ones, and the cheaper ones were around £100. So we couldn't really afford expensive ones. With hardware, it's quite important to have something decent to work with, otherwise if it slows down, it's not going to give them good experience. So we have some devices which works okay, but you know, it would be much more appreciated if we can, you know, get some Wacom tablet or any cheaper devices for them to do some drawing and stuff like that.
Outside of this issue of tech graveyards and device procurement or maintenance, connectivity can be an issue in deploying tech tools for teaching and learning.
Connectivity is a massive issue.
You know, when we moved from capital, Dhaka, to Sylhet, that was the second school we had. And when we're looking for a place, we are looking, you know, is there going to be fiber optic going to go, or are we going to have internet? So we really had to think about that rather than where we'll be based. It was based on internet connectivity and all of that stuff. So yeah, that is a definitely an issue, but you know, it's getting better.
But more than that, storage and data usage can be a serious issue. In some situations, teaching and learning content is competing with official documentation or photos of friends and family.
More and more kids have access to smartphones. They are spending a lot of time either on social media or playing, you know, mobile games on their phones or their parents' phones. So we wanted to kind of use this opportunity to access and reach these children with a learning experience. At the same time, there are certain challenges around the amount of storage that somebody has on their phone, for example. So you're competing with storage with, you know, some of these really amazing, very established games that millions of kids are playing around the world. Access to data is another big one. You know, so all of these things we kind of had to take into account from a tech perspective when designing the app.
How do you actually get content onto devices? You know, the usual way we do it here is you upload something onto the App Store or the Google Play Store. It's downloaded onto devices. You just can't do that in a lot of these markets, partly because, well, first of all, there's no Apple, right? It's all Android. But a lot of the time, these phones are, they're Chinese knockoffs, and you can't even access the Play Store. So you have to sideload content onto these devices. So that's one big problem. But then, because people don't tend to back up their content, because data is very expensive, they can't back it up to the cloud, and they don't have a computer to back it up to, so your app needs to be better than pictures of their kids.
Then there is the day-to-day reality of prioritizing learning whilst in an unpredictable or economically driven environment.
You have to appreciate, you know, or we all appreciate that it's a highly stressful environment where there are a lot of other draws, informal labour markets, ensuring that you're safe, looking after families. And so that precious, precious time that potentially could be after an incredibly long day, to then engage with an education accredited course that actually gives you something tangible that you can then use and move on with is a real challenge.
Well, first of all, from what I think is like, because there is a really different, the situation they live in is quite difficult, so they either need to find work or get to work. They don't have enough time to, you know, just learn for too long. So that's what we find, like they need a quick reward, like either like maybe in 6 months they need to get income coming in, or there's their parents, you know, force them to go you know, do some tutoring or do other kind of job. So I think that one of the things to keep in mind is just like purely not just to train them, also keep in mind, you know, getting income as soon as possible. That's what we found. We had quite difficulty because some of the students come for quite a long time, and you know, if they don't generate an income or if their family don't see they're earning anything, they lose interest. But they don't understand there's a long term, you know, value, and if they learn this, and then their prospect would be really, really high. Because rather than working as a farmer or labor, you know, if you just wait for a year or two to learn a skill, and if you're really good at this, you can really jump up, you know, the salary would be much higher than you would get anywhere else.
But not all our presumptions about apparent challenges to deploying edtech in less connected parts of the world are correct.
By 2030, the majority of all learners on the planet are going to be in Africa, right? So there's a massive opportunity there. But there's also money for edtech companies. You know, one in three Africans are now technically middle class and do have disposable income.
I guess there's a couple of common misconceptions with regards to refugees in general. One of them is that the vast majority of the world's refugees don't live in camps. The vast majority of the world's refugees are urban-based. And that, from a connectivity perspective, is potentially a better thing. But if you are based, you know, within an urban environment, as the most refugees are, you're looking at potentially greater stresses on what you are doing with your time to enable you to engage or give you that time to engage with the education. So, yeah, you've also got coping strategies when you are potentially unable to work because of centralized government legislation about refugees and the right to work. If you've got a device, have you got, for example, access to a charging point on a regular basis? Have you got enough money to pay for, you know, if you are downloading reasonable sized PDFs, for example, just on a very practical level, that can cost a lot of money. And I guess that depends where you are in the world, really.
The opportunity in edtech in less connected parts of the world and beyond is scale. No tool is perfect, but broadening the reach and impact of teaching and learning is an honourable goal, and one that organisations as diverse as the XPRIZE, Ashoka, 100 and many others are attempting to support.
There are 263 million kids that are not in school at the moment, and the vast majority of those are in Africa. We have a teacher shortage of 1.6 million teachers worldwide, and 1.2 million of those are missing in Africa. This is such a crisis that we have in the developing world. And if we think that we're going to solve that by just doing what we do in the UK and doing it a little bit better and a little bit cheaper, it's just never going to happen. I mean, just never going to happen. So EdTech has to be the answer, because frankly, it's the only way we're going to do this. Now, is it there at the moment? No, categorically, it's not. And actually, there are far more successes of EdTech failures than there are of EdTech successes. But it's the only thing we've got that scales. So should we still continue to plug away and try and find, you know, the right answers? I think we have to.
And the idea behind that is really, if we're going to even think about scaling, we want to be confident that what we're doing is effective, and have, you know, credible evidence behind that. So we're most likely going to do a couple of RCTs, so have a group of control schools, as well as the program schools, and really be able to measure, you know, the difference that the program and the application are making.
Yet, intuitively, scale only works if it retains a human flavour to it.
And people are massive, you know, excited about wanting to continue their education after being displaced. The best NGO and best example of EdTech I saw in a humanitarian or development example might be something quite useful. There's a London-based NGO called 1 Billion that work with Nottingham University, and all of their EdTech products, they work heavily in Malawi and a number of other African states, is all evidence-led. And they're very proud, but also work very hard to ensure that they take an evidence-led approach to their EdTech engagement. And just the work that they produce on the ground is absolutely fantastic. You know, not just on a pedagogical perspective, but looking at infrastructure around EdTech. How do you ensure that? One of the problems we face is that EdTech often turns into what's called EdTech graveyards. People can't necessarily repair the items. And there were problems with big EdTech projects. I'm sure some of the listeners will have heard of One Laptop Per Child, which was probably the biggest EdTech project in a development context ever. And you know, that was plagued with issues of not being able to fix the laptops when they broke. And 1 Billion are an example of trying to think about potentially quite difficult environments that you're going to inhabit, and the long-term repercussions of setting up, say, infrastructure to allow people to fix laptops, to teach people engineering skills so that it can be maintained. So they'd be a really good example that I'd look at.
Well, you know what? I mean, education is fundamentally local. It's not global, right? I mean, every single market is kind of different. And those considerations can seem really small, but they have a massive impact on the ground.
As Teodora says,
we feel that educational technology can really be a tool in improving learning outcomes, as well as engagement with a specific topic or with learning itself. But it is limited, you know, and the challenges on the ground are very complex. So there's only so much that technology can do. And there comes a point where it really, you know, kids do need mentors. They need role models. They need that extra support. Teachers need, you know, different strategies and ways to deal with overcrowded classrooms, and very, you know, special learning needs for the students in those classrooms.
There's some really good work, for example, with mass online courses going on in Jordan, especially. There's some fantastic NGOs that I will remember the name of, who are working with Syrian academics who have been displaced, and they are putting them in contact with other Syrian students who potentially they taught before, or actually have become, who are new to a particular topic. We are into what, the 8th year now of the conflict, and that is quite a number of iterations into their understanding of how best to provide those courses. They're really engaging with sort of participatory building of academic content, and have gone to a much more decentralized approach that allows people to pick and choose different parts of the courses that works best in their environment.
You enjoyed this episode looking at the R&D necessary to understand local learner and design needs, how challenges can sometimes be different to those we anticipate, and how to use the lever of technology to bring scale to teaching and learning, but with a very human face and a listening ear. But yeah, I really enjoyed recording this one. And as this is our last episode, a huge thank you to you for your time.
It's been a great experience. I've enjoyed working first with you on organizing the episodes and all of the great guests who've come and contributed. So to all of those folks who served as guests, I want to send out a thank you to them. And I hope that folks have gotten a little bit of flavor of the kinds of research interests that we're looking at Pearson, but also that I think how maybe we fit into the larger technology and education conversation.
And on that note, do you have any kind of final bits of research or upcoming work that you'd like to share, or is there anything else that you'd like us to point out?
I'll just say the biggest things that we're thinking about right now are thinking about implementation and what happens when educational technology actually hits a classroom, and thinking about how we design for those specific things, but also thinking about how, what happens in the classroom really is the driver of whether technology is effective or not, and that it's not just the technology, but how it fits into that whole classroom system. So we're doing a lot of, like I said, thinking and talking and having conversations about how we bring together the technology and the implementation sides of things. And we're definitely looking forward to talking more to folks about that.
As always, we only scratch the surface to what is out there. And I look forward to bringing more programs, projects, and personalities onto the podcast soon. We would love to hear your feedback at Podcast EdTech and at Christine DeSherbo, or check out the Pearson podcast page at tinyurl.com/Pearson Future Tech, where you can also find more content, reports, and insight. I'll drop that link, show notes, and more at theedtechpodcast.com. If you enjoyed the episode and want to hear more on AI, languages, gaming, assessment without tests, and personalized learning, make sure you subscribe to the EdTech Podcast on iTunes, where you can also leave a review. Thanks for listening in, and see you next time.